Hello, freaks, and welcome to Radical Research. This is episode 144 on, well, it's a King Crimson episode. We'll get into the details in just a sec. I have with me, as ever, for the 144th time, Hunter Ginn.
Good evening, everyone. Good evening, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here for the 144th time.
Yeah,
So,
144.
I'm thinking today, we've been doing this for 8 years now. And it's
we have
to me.
And I think because it's our 144th, we have to invoke Agent Steele and say 144, await the opening of the door. Door, 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 door. Too cult, bro. Too
Always
cult.
Happy to invoke Agent Steele.
Especially in a King Crimson episode. I mean, this is our world. This is our world, not your
I
world.
I guarantee you that Juan Garcia likes King Crimson.
Yeah, I would think so. I think that tracks. Well, you know, King Crimson certainly, and we will get into this, of course, more later. But they certainly have had so much crossover appeal with the metal audience, because Fripp himself has sometimes referred to Crimson as a metal band, and I think with our exercise tonight, it might show that he's not exactly wrong either. Yeah. We'll get into that. First of all, some house cleaning. Patreon.com/radicalresearchpodcast is the best way to support us. If you like what we do and want to throw a little bit of cheddar our way, it helps defray hosting costs, any problems I have, and I have to call our buddy Micah and get him on the horn, and I have to pay that guy, and it helps with all that stuff. And we really appreciate just any level of support that shows that you're with us, that you enjoy listening to us, and we love having you with us. And if you want to donate like Ryan Grove just did, Ryan's our latest contributor. Thank you, Ryan Grove. Just go to patreon.com/radicalresearchpodcast. I want to say a word real quick about emails to us. We really do welcome emails. We don't really prefer, in fact, we don't prefer at all DMs, as they say, as the kids say on social media. They just tend to get overlooked because neither Hunter or I are super fixed to our phones where social media is concerned. So if you want to get a hold of us, write to radicalresearchpodcast@gmail.com. It may take us a while to get back to you, but we will get back to you. And we definitely always read everyone's comments. And we're really thankful for everybody who does contact us with their enthusiasm. You can also go to radicalresearch.org/Voivod if you are interested in my Voivod book. It's called Always Moving, The Strange Multiverse of Voivod. It's a 540-page monster that basically, when you get it in the mail, it will be as if you went to the door having ordered a Chicago pizza pie. It's heavy. It's a very heavy package. And I'm proud of that. And I hope that I've made it all 540 pages count. But please go there to radicalresearch.org/Voivod for your Voivod book. Now, this is the penultimate installment of my thanks to the many, many, many people, the scores of wonderful people who helped me out so much and gave me a lot of gifts of music, whether that be CD, LP, shirts, books, whatever it was, after the fire that occurred almost a year and a half ago. I don't really want to belabor the point of the fire. It's an unfortunate, still an unfortunate fact of life for me, but I'm not looking for any more sympathy or gifts. However, I want to thank everybody, and I've been thanking people the last, what, 4 or 5 episodes, who were generous enough to come to my aid without even me asking, which makes me a very, very grateful human being. I want to give thanks to the next batch of people: Eric Lynch, Ken Golden, Jeff Kiefer. In a group, I will thank Eula Garrett, Leif Jensen, and Thomas Weber from Century Media and Inside Out, David Gelke, Sue Verica, who used to be known as Sue Knowles, Sean Pallotta, Matt Radzinski, and Jason Hundy. I love you all. I truly, truly do. Thank you. Now, we've always wanted to do a show on King Crimson, and I think you and I, Hunter, have featured them here and there. I know we put them on a Fusion Decapitations once.
Like a math rock episode, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, they've been around, and certainly they come up in the conversation about as often as something like Voivod or Fate's Warning or Black Sabbath or Van der Graaff Generator or any number of our other favorites. But I was always, and I want to hear from you, Hunter, of course. We never really talked too seriously about doing one until I had this idea to do what we're doing on this episode. But it felt almost impossible to just do a discography dive because in doing that, you leave out the live element because King Crimson Live is a whole other beast. And you could say that about a lot of bands, but I really feel like you could say that about King Crimson in a more significant way.
Yeah,
Like,
I feel like King Crimson is as vital live as they were on record. I think there is enough documentation to confirm that. They're one of the very few rock bands capable of improvising and making their music new and alive every night, the way that a jazz band would. There are too many dimensions. There are too many extra musical aspects in terms of membership, eras, to do a manageable one show synopsis of King Crimson. Too many themes that would be neglected. There's too much information to do that in any way that would be a worthy representation of that band, as far as I'm concerned.
And you make a great point about them being as malleable and exciting from night to night as a jazz band. That's probably a lot of the reason King Crimson heads like us like to delve into a lot of the live shows that Fripp has put out there for everyone that run the gamut of their discography, or I shouldn't say their discography, their career. They're just as exciting to listen to live as they are in studio, and they're a different animal. But what we figured we'd do, I just had kind of this light bulb moment a few weeks ago where I thought, well, let's just look at all the Lark's Tongues. And let me explain to those who don't know, Lark's Tongues and Aspic is their 1973 album. Their would that be their fifth? One, two, three, four. Yeah, their fifth with an entirely new lineup. And it was called Lark's Tongues and Aspic. And it's bookended by Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part One and Two, one of their greatest albums. And they continued the Lark's Tongue theme in title and certainly musically with three, four, and another one, a fifth one in 2000. I guess the final one was 2003. And we're going to just survey the Lark's Tongue songs. Vocal stuff notwithstanding, because these are all instrumental. This is a pretty good overview of King Crimson if you don't know them, and just a great celebration of them if you do know them. Why don't we just kick it off with a nice long snippet to ease in? Get yourself something to drink, something cold to drink, turn the lights down low, and settle back. This is going to be two moments from Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part One from the album of the same name. I picked one of the snippets, and you picked the other one, and here we go.
Thank you. Every so often we play something, and I think this is everything that I need in music. That encapsulated in one thing. And I had that feeling when we were playing this just now. This is such an interesting lineup too. And I mean, that's another of Fripp's, many gifts is being able, he's kind of like Miles Davis in that way. In finding new talent to refresh and forward his vision. And having David Cross and Jamie Muir, I think especially, I think Jamie Muir is a really underrated figure in the story of King Crimson. I think
Well,
he added so much to this.
he did and he does. I think the only reason he's probably not the most well-known name is 'cause he only lasted one album. His time was very short, kind of like Boz Burrell or any number of King Crimson guys that stayed for one album. Like he was such a big part of Lark's Tongue's the album, and their live show around this time too. Like the guy would chomp on blood capsules and like look like he's spitting blood, kind of like pre-Gene Simmons, and he'd wear fur and he was a percussionist. Opposite Bruford on the trap kit, he's playing percussion and bashing the shit out of it and doing it with a lot of grace and aggression. Just an incredible member. And David Cross, you mentioned, is a violinist. And let's talk about real quick. It's Robert Fripp, of course, on guitar, John Wetton on bass and vocals, and then Bill Bruford on drums, of course, who came from Yes at this point.
And I think that aspect of having Muir and Bruford really kind of prefigures the double trio that they would explore on Thrack.
In the mid-90s, yes,
Yeah, exactly.
yep.
Sort of reversed because, here we have Bruford laying down the foundation and then Muir adding all these ornaments. And in the double trio, Pat Mostolato, great, great, great drummer, one of our favorites.
We'll talk more about him, most definitely. Yeah.
It becomes the anchor. And then Bruford is left to explore, some of the his own maniacal percussive whimsy.
That's a great observation. I think you're so dead on. I've never really quite thought of it like that. I never thought of the shape or structure of it like that. That's great. But what's funny about it is Pat Mastelotto then Once Bruford left after the Thrack era, Pat Mastelotto became the main drummer for a while. And then later on, the lineup we saw with Yoko on guitar, Mel Collins came back, that whole weird three drummer lineup that they only did live stuff. They didn't really record a proper studio album together. And that was the last incarnation of Crimson that existed thus far. In that lineup, Mastelotto went back to being the Spice, the kind of like oddball and quirky Spice on the margin. And then they had Gavin Harrison being that foundational drummer, I think. And then whoever, Bill Rieflin or whoever, Jeremy Stacey, those guys were sort of like the lukewarm water in the middle of the hot and cold there. But it's just funny how Mastelotto, just by your observation, is just so good at playing all these different roles in the
He
band.
is.
But I would say this has to be, if I had to choose, and I don't, thankfully I don't have to, but if I had to choose, this right here, this five-man lineup that existed so briefly, is very much my favorite King Crimson lineup.
I would second that. Again, thankfully we don't have to make such an agonizing choice. But gun to head, this is my favorite.
I mean, listen to them, like all that cacophony and like that stretching and contracting and going balls out here and restraining contemplatively over here. Like it's just fuck, man. Like this is why we love Crimson. This is why they're one of our favorite bands. And I
I
think,
mean, sounds contemporary now.
oh, totally. Yeah. And I like the sort of more pastoral or more, I'm not going to say dated. We have talked about how you and I don't really like that term, because if it came out in 69 or 70, well, God bless it for sounding 69 and 70. I don't care if it's not timeless. But what's interesting is this is, I think, the first one of what King Crimson had put out, their fifth album, that doesn't sound of its time necessarily. I think the first four albums all sound of their time. I mean, by their nature of what they're doing creatively, they are far ahead of their time. But I'm just saying those albums sound like products of the years that they were born. And this one, I don't know, man. You could have recorded that 3 years ago. Do you know what I'm saying? Like it holds up in that way too. Anyhow, we're gonna play the final song from the Larks, Tongues, and Aspic album. They give us part one, which we just sampled some of. We work through a few more hills and valleys and great songs as the album goes along, and then they end with part two of Larks, Tongues, and Aspic.
All right.
Ready? Hold on, hold on, hold up, hold up. I'm not ready yet. 1 second. Where are my snippets?
Woman,
Shit. Woman?
where my snippets at?
Woman?
Did you move my snippets?
Oh, shit. Okay, here we go. So, man, we talked about metal. We hear the cacophony again. We hear the metallic element. I will never forget when I first got into King Crimson. It was like 92, 93. I picked up the album Starless and Bible Black and the USA live album. I worked at a college bookstore at the time, and they had these cheaply in this cassette rack. And I really never bought cassettes, but I thought, I'm going to take a chance on this band who I know I've heard Voivod talk about them. I know I've heard other metal bands talk about them. And this was the era when I'm 22, 23 years old and starting to venture outside of metal, for real. And that was, aided a few years prior to that by things like Helios Creed and Melvins and No Means No and things like that. But I really wanted to go check out this King Crimson band. Of course, I knew 21st Century Schizoid Band. I'd always loved that, but I never really went further, And so I get these things, and then I finally get Lark's Tongues. I think Lark's Tongues was the next thing I got. And although there are hints of Voivod on Starless and Bible Black, which was the album that came after Lark's Tongues, same lineup minus Jamie Muir, I will never forget listening to the Lark's songs and going, aha. That is where Voivod got it in terms of why they're always talking about King Crimson. No wonder. And it's very Voivodian, or I should say, Voivod were very Crimsonian. And I think we hear the evidence all over Lark's Tongues Part Two. Even that's a longer song, obviously. We just played a snippet of it. If you sit down and listen to Part Two and you know Voivod, it will all click.
Oh, no question. Yeah, no question. And I also love the way that King Crimson restates melodic themes or, reconfigures them.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously that's one of the, I guess, the classical aspects of King Crimson, which is, a huge part of Fripp's upbringing and training. But they were one of the first rock bands, I think, to do that really, really successfully. And again, we were talking about you. I love the phrase that you used about malleability, because that's a really great example of that characteristic of King Crimson sound, is
Sure,
how
sure.
they just mold and bend and navigate through all these, different corridors. And then come back and take the same melodic material, the same thematic material, and like once they've they've been through the wormhole and back, it comes back in a new form, and it's just really fresh.
And I think that must be, and I can't speak for Fripp and the rest of the band, but that must be why Lark's Tongues is what it is in terms of it being this mammoth five-part song that stretches out over decades,
Right.
because they are revisiting things. And I think Fripp also employed that even more so in the mid-90s Thrack era, where Thrack and Vroom throughout the Thrack album, and there are other songs like People and Dinosaur that don't do this. But Thrack and Vroom tend to sort of like be knotted and these kind of partners, symbiotic partners, where they're revisiting themselves and morphing and changing. And there's, several different movements of each one. And I think what happened, this is not necessarily a critique, but it's maybe a little bit critique, is that Fripp started to kind of get so bound into the Thrack Vroom way of thinking again. As you so aptly described, which began, I think, with Lark's Tongues, really in earnest. He began to really keep doing that on Construction of Light, on Power to Believe. And then with later live improvs that became songs in the what we'll call the Yoko era, that last era, the three drummer era, where stuff started to me to almost sound too similar. Like it was almost like he was leaning too much on these very familiar rhythmic patterns and these very familiar time signatures and just ways of doing the King Crimson big riff or big slab as it really is. But it is just part of his thing. And you open up a can of worms here, because if you look at the era, I guess it was probably, well, they partly designed this era by, being a band that started in 1969 with a very radical In the Court of the Crimson King debut. They helped create this era where everybody was more open to doing things like that, right? To do these like multi-tiered, multi-part type songs where you are revisiting themes and playing on them. I mean, that wasn't happening in pre-69 music, as far as I know. And so you look at something like 21st Century Schizoid Man, and the next album had Pictures of a City on it. And Pictures of a City is kind of an interesting rewrite of 21st Century. It's got a lot of similar elements. And so I think Fripp was always just going to be doing this. It was just part of his DNA, I
Yeah,
guess.
I mean, those first two records sort of mirror each other.
Very much, very much. But you never felt cheated because there's
No, no,
always
no.
a freshness and a newness to the ideas.
Well, and I wasn't alive, but I can only imagine that despite the kind of symmetry between those two records, what they were doing to begin with was so new that the second record still felt new. You know what I mean? Like, even a lateral step for King Crimson still felt like a step forward.
Oh yeah, it felt like the space shuttle launch into new territory. I mean,
Right,
it's just
right.
for sure, for sure. Now the title. Let's talk about the title, "Lark's Tongues and Aspic," for a second. I think it's fascinating. I think it's intriguing. It's so memorable and weird. This was coined by Jamie Muir to describe the music's contrast, and I'm going to read from the AI overview here. I'm not going to claim that I'm quoting this myself. Quote, "Delicate, precious moments encased within aggressive, structured, chaotic noise." And it goes on to say the phrase metaphorically represents something fragile, the lark's tongues, preserved inside a solid, restrictive form, the aspic. I mean, Jamie Muir, man, again, MV.
What he went hard for one album.
Oh, he burned brightly for a very short time. One of those bright flames that burns so fucking hard for a very short period of time. I mean, that's really incredible. Now, here's something, and let's talk about this delicacy. Eating lark tongue in aspic was actually a delicacy back when the Romans were doing their thing, and some later European aristocrats found it appealing too, and they would eat this thing, this delicacy, and it died out. But aspic is a kind of savory jelly. I don't know much about it, but I this is for you, Hunter, because
I grew up in aspic country.
Wait a minute, what?
Aspic, like my grandmother and my great aunt, we used to have this thing, tomato aspic, which I always found quite disgusting. But it was a staple and apparently it's a very southern thing.
I didn't know shit about aspic as an Iowa boy.
No, it's not. It's a very southern thing, at least from like the 50s through the, I guess, the 80s, because that's when I first encountered it. I mean, but it's aspic has a weird history. Like, there's this Gilded Age dish called Ulsan Gelée, which is basically just eggs, boiled eggs suspended in aspic. But yeah, we used to have the stuff on. We would go over to my grandmother and great aunt's house on Sunday for lunch, and there were many Sundays when we would have tomato aspic, and my mom also found it quite disgusting, and she didn't make me eat it, but it would, and it was, it's exactly what it sounds like, and it was just this like red gelatin, and they would bring it to the table, and it would, wobble. Because that's what gelatin does. And it is. It's just like this savory kind of jelly.
Okay, well, I knew nothing of aspic until King Crimson, and even then I still haven't had it. It's and look, you're talking about tomatoes and aspic. I'd much rather have tomatoes and aspic than
Why
lark
would
tongue.
you? Yeah, because
This sounds gross to me. I've never eaten tongue and I never will, but what about you? Would you, in celebration of King Crimson, ever want to try a lark's tongue in aspic?
I would try a lark's tongue. I would prefer it not to be. I would prefer it to be braised, because I eat, like, if I go to get tacos, lengua is probably my first order anywhere.
What's that?
Cow tongue.
Fucking gross.
It's incredible. It tastes like pot roast. And I could give it to you, and you would have no idea what you were eating. And
Well,
it's the most delicious things on earth.
I don't even like pot roast when I was eating meat as a kid and way before I went vegetarian. I had no interest in pot roast even. So I think I'll leave this to you.
Okay.
I was really hoping you'd be doing this episode just kind of while you're snacking on lark's tongues and aspic, but I guess you didn't bring it to the table, did you?
Well, I went to Publix today and they were fresh out.
Yeah, I'm like, when you discovered King Crimson in this album, were you like, oh, I got to go to Food Lion and look for some lark's tongue, you know?
Right. Yeah. You guys got any lark's tongue?
Fresh
I
out,
see
buddy.
the
Fresh
I
out.
see the chicken thighs. Not seeing any lark's tongue.
And then he directed you toward the cat food.
Oh.
You like that?
That's a pretty good one.
King Crimson fans, write in, see if you get that joke. You probably will. I mean, if you're into
I
Crimson,
would probably.
you should get that. Anyway, so that's the story on the title. I'm glad Jamie was in this band, man. He just gave, like we said earlier, I'm just still marveling at how much he gave in the little time he was there. But we move ahead. This basic lineup of Crimson minus Muir would make two more albums, Starless and Bible Black, and then of course Red being one of the very, 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 very best that this band ever did in the studio.
One of the best albums of all time. Also.
With perhaps you've talked about maybe your favorite song, that D David Sylvian song. What's that called again?
Oh, Forbidden Colors.
Forbidden Colors. If I had to pick a favorite song, it could be King Crimson Starless,
That's probably my second.
from the Red album. Yeah. Then they break up. Fripp dissolves the whole thing. He does a few weird things for a few good years and comes back in 80-81 with Adrian Belew on guitar and vocals, Tony Levin on bass, and he brings back Bill Bruford. And they're called Discipline, and then they change their name to King Crimson and release an album together called Discipline. They release another album called Beat, and they release a third album together called Three of a Perfect Pair. This is 1984 by now, and on Three of a Perfect Pair, we see Lark's Tongues coming back in Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part 3.
Thank you.
Brilliant.
A little past brilliant. New textures, new production, new lineup.
New clothing. Let's cut to the chase right here. New.
Definitely new clothing. New haircuts,
New haircuts.
but and new influences too.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, the 80s, one of the, I would say for me, one of the maybe the defining aspect of 80s King Crimson is the contrapuntal guitar interplay between Fripp and Ballou. And obviously very influenced by the, Fripp moved to New York, was there with Brian Eno in the late 70s, early 80s, soaked up everything that was going on there. Obviously, was listening to Steve Reich and Philip Glass and co-opted their compositional methods into to King Crimson. Obviously in sort of a rock context, but yeah, but so all this new stuff that we're talking about, the spirit of the composition is still there. I mean, it is thoroughly Lark's Tongue.
Thoroughly, and it's thoroughly King Crimson. I know that some people at the time and even since have thought, well, the Discipline era, we'll just call it the Discipline era, the 80s era Crimson, it wasn't King Crimson. It's like, it sounds like Talking Heads or, just because Adrian Belew happened to have some vocal similarity to David Byrne. And, he technically was a live member of Talking Heads, I think for some, at some point, but no, I disagree. I think King Crimson's always been King Crimson. I've always trusted Fripp to bring it back when it's right. I'm not cynical about the fact that, oh, he's making more money because it's called King Crimson rather than Discipline. It's King Crimson. And as you say, there's just so many more influences coming into it and so many more life experiences. I mean, there's 7 years between Red and Discipline. He also got into, I don't know how you say it, gamelan music, a very,
Gamelan.
gamelan,
Well, but Gamelan was a huge influence on Steve Reich and Terry Riley and well and probably Lamonte Young and probably Glass too. And yeah, I mean, so it's all, it's all sort of downstream.
it all makes a shit ton of sense in King Crimson world, the way he filters it, through the band, and out comes those three great albums from the 80s. Every single one of them fantastic. I don't think there's really a bad moment on those, really.
Oh God, I love that era.
Yeah,
Love.
for sure. For sure. So nice to see Lark's Tongue's bridging 70s Crimson to the 80s. We have Bill Bruford, of course, Tony Levin, every bit the bass master as Wetton is, but they're just very different players. Obviously, Wetton didn't play a stick for one, but Tony
Wetton
Levin,
had no funk fingers.
funk fingers, but Tony Levin, but Tony Levin also couldn't do the blower bass the way John Wetton did. And I use that term with great respect to Blackie of Voivod, but to me, the blower bass was influenced by Chris Squire and John Wetton. It almost had to be.
No question. Yes.
Well, and Lemmy. We'll throw him in there.
You
But
need a
yeah.
you need a yeah, I mean, so two of those guys were Rick guys, but Wetton played primarily a P bass, didn't he?
And but he got such a massive sound out of it, which I think
God, yeah,
is
he did.
had to be as much like the amp setup and everything else that he was doing, but incredible bassist. So it just, I again, it illustrates how Fripp was able to bring in such high level players, the highest level of all. So they go dormant again after the Three of a Perfect Pair era. They don't come back until I think 94, 95, when that Vroom EP came out, and we have Bruford back in the band. Of course, Fripp, of course, and of course, Adrian Belew and Tony Levin. So he brings back the principal players from the 80s and adds a guy named Trey Gunn on war guitar. Trey Gunn's sort of like never really been a bassist or a guitarist. He's just sort of at least his role in Crimson, right? It's sort of.
Yeah. God, that and you may have seen them. Did you see them on the Power to Believe tour?
I did not.
Okay. I did.
I
And
know. Yeah.
he was so Because you saw the double trio a couple of times, right?
I
Yeah.
saw the Thrack Tour twice, once in
Okay.
Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania, once in Boston. Yeah.
So, but when, all right, so on the Power to Believe tour, he had a Chapman stick and a war guitar. Maybe he had two war guitars. I don't know. But anyway, he had one on a table, and then he had one that he actually played, on a strap. And he was just like, he would kind of move. He would, play, with the one that was appended to him. But then he would play the one on the tabletop and the strapped one at the same time. And he would just kind of move back and forth between the two. It was astounding.
War guitar, for people that don't know, was invented by a guy named Mark Warr, Warr. 7 to 14 strings on these things. They're just crazy looking things. The first thing that drops out of the alien ship when they land, it's this thing. And but it's a touch style instrument. It's sort of between the stick and a guitar. The stick being, I think the stick has more in common with a bass than a guitar. Partly because of the range, the low range, and partly because of the, playing it with your fingers. But anyway, it's, is it a guitar? Is it a bass? Who knows? Who cares? Doesn't matter.
It's a hermaphrodite of an instrument, and it doesn't matter. It's amazing.
Dude, hermaphrodite of an instrument. That's awesome. Hey, Alan Coulson calling you. We need a meme.
I don't know. Don't yeah. No, don't entice Alan.
Oh no, do. I love it. Anyway, so that's the lineup. Plus, Pat Mastelotto comes in on percussion and some drums, of course. Before that, his resume included XTC for a brief period of time, and who I love. I'm a huge XTC fan. I know you're a fan, and also Mr. Mister. So,
Is great, really.
who knew that Pat Mastelotto was such a monster? But here he comes, the Thrack
Well, what's
era.
funny, and I think we've told this story on the show before, but we know Jeff Porcaro,
Toto.
yeah, from Toto, yeah. Well, and everything else, one of the greatest drummers of all time, died tragically early, but even still. One of the most recorded session drummers of all time. I mean, he was just, yeah, just an incredible musician. And his father, Joe Porcaro, is a really famous instructor. And so Pat Mastelotto goes to him for lessons. And he said, Joe Porcaro told him, he said, you need to, he's like, I'm not trying to be rude, but you need to figure out something else to do with your life. He said, you've got
Well,
no time, no chops, and no technique.
he said this to Mastalotto. Wow.
Mastelotto, I'll try to find the used to be like called Drum Talk or something. And Mastelotto like is talking about his career. And yeah, he tells him those three things. He's like, you got no time, no chops, and no technique. And it's like, what am I hearing?
Yeah, I
Well,
what's
he's got a like. I mean, when you like AB him to Gavin Harrison or to Bruford, he does have like a cruder approach to the instrument, but he's incredibly musical. I think he's got killer time.
I think he's got such a natural talent. Like I look at that guy, I'm like, he was born to do this. And no, I don't think he's technically a Gavin Harrison. Of course not. He's not technically a Bill Bruford, but what he is a Pat Mastelotto, and he's got shit ton of character on his chosen instrument. I think he's fantastic. And
I love him.
what I've learned about seeing him now, I guess, he's, I guess besides Fripp, he's the one I've seen the most in Crimson, because I've seen Crimson 5 times, and every single time Mastalotto's been there. So I've learned that my ear and eye go to him a lot in these shows. And I've seen Stickmen a few times, which he's in with Tony Levin and Marcus Aaron. Great dude, great player. And he's phenomenal. And that's interesting, but maybe it's just not, he's not tr traditionally talented, but he's certainly, I think, where it matters, incredibly talented. So, all this to say, this is this
I'm gonna say that J Joe Porcaro wrong on that one.
wrong. Joe Picaro,
Wrong.
Joe Picaro, wrong on taxes. Wrong. Wrong for you. Don't vote. Don't vote Joe Picaro.
Little bit of pre-midterm humor.
Little pre-midterm humor from Radical Research. It's what you expect. It's why you need to go to Radical Research Patreon page and donate. You're not going to get this anywhere else. All this to say, there was this six-man lineup that came back. The next album after Thrack, The Construction of Light, Bruford and Levin leave. So you've got Ballou and Fripp with the what we'll call the newer guys, Mastalatto and Trey Gunn. And in 2000, Lark's Tongues rears its head again with Part Four. And let me tell you, buddy.
Hey, bud.
Hey, bud, this is a long song. We've got two snippets from it. It's kind of pointless to describe, but this destroys. This is decapitation. When we talk about fusion decapitation or any kind of musical decapitation, I think you'll hear what we're talking about. We're going to listen to Lark's Tongues Part Four from Construction of Light.
Thank you.
Look, I don't mean to shame anybody out there. This is not what radical
Was
research.
gonna, that was a
You're about to shame. This is not what radical research is about. We're an open arms type organization. We welcome people that listen differently than us. If you're here, you're obviously a listener of a similar stripe as we are. But so I'm not going to shame here. But if you're into metal and you're not listening to this band, what the fuck, man?
That's not shame. That you're that's a public service, Jeff, that you and I are providing.
It's a question. What the fuck, man?
No.
I mean,
It's
listen to that. Listen to that destroy. It's just,
yeah. You don't need to go to therapy. Listen to King Crimson.
Well, you were going to shame. What's your shame?
Chavez, who you know, a fantastic band, but for me,
Wait, who? What? Who?
Chavez,
Chavez?
you don't know you don't know Chavez,
I don't know shit. Apparently, I don't know Chavez from Shinola, but.
dude. How many times have like you've seen Chavez on my playlist? And I haven't like we have listeners that love Chavez.
Probably. I've probably seen it on your list and gone, ah, it's just some fancy rock I'm not going to like, you know.
They're an incredible band.
Okay. Okay.
Gone Glimmering is like one of my favorite albums of the favorite kind of fancy rock albums of the 90s.
Okay.
It's not that fancy, but anyway,
Cool.
they're an
Yes.
incredible New York band from the mid 90s. But they have a song called Break Up Your Band. And when I was listening to this, I was thinking, if you have a band, you should break up because you will never do anything that good.
Yeah, that's fucking.
Yeah,
Yeah,
fuck your
well,
band. Yeah.
sure enough. Yeah, sure enough, man.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a great.
I'm gonna break up the nine bands I'm in.
Right. Yeah, John Agaloc is no more. Because listen to this.
I've thought, yeah, we should listen to this. And now
Because
what?
listen to this. Yeah. Great stuff. I mean, again, and very much in the Lark's Tongues and Aspic spirit, you know, just heavy, dark, angular, weird. It does have some of the similar themes, of course. How does that fit into the Lark's Tongue catalog for you?
Well, you know, it's so interesting question because I have very mixed feelings on this album. It's super uneven. And I remember like getting it, and obviously it starts rather inauspiciously, as we both know.
Well, it's okay. Let's let listeners in on that. That's it starts with a song called
The cow in the room, shall we say? Yeah.
the ugly cow in the room, Prozac Blues. Don't like it at all. And as an opener, it's even more befuddling because you always want to start an album with a great song, with one of the highlights of the album, right? But no, it
Yeah.
starts with maybe the worst King Crimson song, right?
I think it's probably the worst. And
I
also at
skip.
the time, oh, go ahead.
No, I skip it, but I love something like The World's My Oyster, Soup, Floor, Kitchen, Wax
Oh,
Museum,
yeah.
whatever. That's great.
There's some great lyrics on that record too,
Oh
actually.
yeah, Adrian's a great
Blue
lyricist.
is
Yeah.
pretty, yeah,
But
inspired.
I'll give you that. This is an uneven record.
You know, I wasn't thrilled about the, you know, kind of only electronic drums on it. I never minded that part of King Crimson. In fact, I liked it as a supplement, but just the purely electronic drums, because I, again, it kind of takes away from Mastolato's Mastolatoness.
Sure.
And so I don't know, there were, I had issues with the record, but I remember getting to that point in the record going, well, you know, it's really hard to argue against this. And it, I think it stands up as some of the strongest King Crimson. Like those moments that we played, I mean, I would put that up against not only the best of King Crimson, the best about any band, really.
I love Lark's Four. I think it's you know, obviously that second part of that snippet where they're just raging on the guitar and the accents with it. It's frightening. It's apocalyptic. It's everything I love about this band when they get really, really heavy. And of course, you know, like any King Crimson album, there are peaks and valleys, and it's not all heavy. It's not all dark, and that's what's wonderful about them. The other, I think, real huge highlight on this album is the title track. also has some frightening guitar work, but also just some beautiful atmospheres. So it's a befuddling album.
Well, and we didn't even talk about the quantum physics that they played in that first half of the snippet.
How do you write that out? Like that's some tough to follow shit in some way.
Not sure there was notation involved in that. Maybe. Sure.
Well,
Zappa
and
could probably transcribe that, but
yeah, that's that weird sort of telekinetic hive mind I think you have to have when you're in King Crimson. They are kind of beyond human in a lot of ways. It's incredible. So it seemed like Lark's Tongues was over. They did come out with another album called The Power to Believe. I have often put this up and still put this up as one of my very, very, very favorite King Crimson albums. I love The Power to Believe so much. We get the return of a more organic sounding drum, which is fantastic. And same lineup as Construction. Although I think later in that tour, didn't Levin come in place of Gunn, I think. I think Levin came.
I'm not sure about that.
Levin didn't play in the album, but he came in for Gunn. And anyway, it doesn't matter. Level 5 is a
Ooh.
song that they released as an EP before the album came out. It was like many Crimson songs, it was one that was built from some live recordings, some improvs in the live set. But Level 5 is a bona fide song. And even though it's not called Lark's Tongues and Aspic Part 5, in Fripp's own interesting way, this is considered Lark's 5. And this is a little bit from Level 5.
That is some of the most insane call and response guitar work ever recorded. And I love how it moves from those really sort of Venusian loose sections with Baloo. Dude, Baloo is one of, I think, rock guitar's great colorists. That guy just it can paint pictures. Like in you can, it's so visual the way he plays. It really sounds like he's just playing lines like the way that a painter would paint brush strokes. But it's, dude, it's so heavy too. It's so heavy. And when they start doing the call and response part, it is just like you said it best. I forget exactly what you said. You used the word frightening. I know that. But that is exactly what it is. I mean, it is menacing, it is intimidating. It's like you are in the presence of something that will eat you alive.
Well, there's nothing more I can add to that. I completely agree. Sorry, Marty. Man, just and one of my favorite productions on any Crimson album is on this one. I think they nailed it. And I think if this is the last studio album, which I believe it probably will be, I think they go out on the highest of notes.
I agree.
And man, just destructive. And again, an album of great beauty, because within what we
I
heard
want to.
there.
I was gonna say, maybe we shouldn't, tell the legions how the sausage is made, but I'm just gonna like propose this at some point, because we have a lot of other things ahead of us. But I think it would be wonderful to do King Crimson ballad episode.
Ooh,
I
you know
think
what's
they
it,
may.
dude?
I think they write some of the most gorgeous ballads ever. Eyes Wide Open on this album.
Eyes Wide Open on this album, Mate Kudasai, Heartbeat.
Yep.
Yeah, well, that's a great, dude, that's a great idea, because in my notes, I kind of keep on my phone, I keep a just a running section on radical research ideas, just shit you and I have talked about, or shit that just occurs to me. One of them was a just a ballad episode,
Oh,
not King Crimson.
yeah.
Not King Crimson, but just great ballad. And I think that you honed in on one that I'm really interested in doing with you. We should do the King Crimson ballads in about 15, 20 episodes. Give this one room to breathe. But dude, we finally did a King Crimson episode. How does it feel?
It feels great. Jeff, I've never felt better.
Never felt, wow. Okay. Well,
It
it's the new calisthenics. You don't have to exercise your body. Just listen to King Crimson. Yeah, there's not much more I can say than what we've already said. All praise to Fripp and company, all these just amazing magicians that have enhanced our life so much. And this is one of those bands, and they're a top five band for me. I can't imagine life without King Crimson. I really truly can't.
Neither can I.
So what's next? Well, what's next is episode 145, and we're going to bring back a band we sort of looked at on episode 2. Way back in the dark ages, back when we had no idea what we were doing. We did an episode on Dan Swano, Dan Svanja, however you say it in Swedish, the great Dan Swano, we'll say. We covered things like Edge of Sanity. I think we did some Moon Tower. We did some Panthymonium, and I think we did a Route 9 song, didn't we?
Get a
Pretty
route
sure.
nine. Yeah. We went all in.
But Hunter and I are such massive fans of Panthymonium, and I was looking at that episode recently, just in terms of what we covered of Panthymonium, and it was very little, just not enough. And I think we need to do a full episode on Panthymonium, and so we're going to do that. They had a fairly short career, but there's plenty to talk about and plenty to listen to. So join us for that one.
Those steel drums.
Those steel drums.
Yeah, they brought that shit in Kirabujin.
Oh yeah, and we did play Karabujan on that, and you talked about, I think, how steel drums is one of your least favorite instruments.
Fucking hate steel drums. Still do.
Still do. Nothing's changed. Some things don't
Nothing's
change.
changed.
It's
8 year,
that's
8 years later.
8 years later, Hunter Gibbons still
And
hates.
also, like with my accent, there's no difference between steel and steel.
Oh, nice. Okay.
Like Naked City.
Naked City.
Naked City. Woo!
That's great. Well, join us for Panthymonium. Thank you for listening. RadicalResearch.org/Voivod. I'm telling you need this book. I read it once. It's pretty good.
It's not bad.
I read it about 157 times. God damn it. I'm sick of it. We're going to leave with another Crimson song. Now, I couldn't help myself. This was just sort of a whimsical idea, but We talked about larks' tongues, and I'm sorry for all the larks who died so that their tongues could be eaten in aspic. I mean, what a bunch of crap that is. But I love birds, and King Crimson has a song called Deception of the Thrush, a much different bird than a lark. But this song, Deception of the Thrush, has nothing to do with larks' tongues and aspic, the song. It just involves a bird. And I don't even know if it's about a bird, if it's named because of the tongue disease or whatever, the mouth disease, because thrush is either the bird or a tongue disease. So, who knows? It could be a bird with a tongue disease. Perhaps that's where we're going with this.
I think Blake Psalm's going to record a song called Battery of the Brown Thrasher.
Battery of the Brown Thrasher. I love it. Oh, here we
That's
go.
the Georgia
Okay.
State bird, if anybody's interested in knowing that little trivia.
If anybody's keeping track of our state bird references, along with the what'd you call it, the pre-midterm election jokes.
Yeah.
But it's a cool song. It's a cool song title, "Deception of the Thrush." I
It's
just
a
love that,
great song title.
and it's a fantastic song. And it's one that morphed quite a bit in the live environment. It's something we talked about regarding Crimson and their character. This one was only a live thing. It never was on a proper album release, but it seemed to be played often enough and would morph often enough that it really could have been on an album. It's too bad it wasn't, but we have the live recordings. We're just going to end the show with a couple minutes from Deception of the Thrush, keeping with the bird aspect, and it seems like a fitting outro. So, Hunter, until next time, till 145, till Panthemonium, till death.
Well, let's not say that. Till next time.
Fight till death.
Yeah.
The
Okay.
Slayer song. The Slayer song. Fight till death.
Or let's fucking die.
Is a clever match to the one you're not just a match.